I don't want to get morbidly engaged with this military stuff, but it's got me quite excited, man, having dreams and everything else. And we were talking about the fog of war. I mean, well, the main reason is that the Book of Mormon sets this forth so beautifully, so clearly, so succinctly, though 170 pages is quite an essay on war, but it treats every aspect. It doesn't leave anything untouched, and it's marvelous, and everything in its context. You'll notice this. You keep your eyes open, and you'll see this. Now, he's been talking about the fog of war. Well, this is very typical in the Book of Mormon. But this that Clausewitz says, and it's also an admonition to us, war is the province of chance. It increases the uncertainty of every circumstances and deranges the course of events. Of course, of mice and men, you see. But Mousie, thou art not alone in proving foresight may be vain. The best laid, you all know this line, the best laid plans of mice and men gain oft delay, and leave us not with grief and pain for promised joy. Still thou art blessed compared with me. The present only toucheth thee, for ach, I backward cast my knee on prospects drear, and forward, though I cannot see, I guess and fear. We can't see what's going to happen, but we can be afraid because it's lights out, this sort of thing. Well, this is the best laid plans of mice and men, famous line of Burns, of course. And it's so more than anywhere, of course, is in war, where you can very well guess and occur. He says, quoting him again, differences of opinion are nowhere so great as in war. Look what it did when Mark Clark wanted to take Rome out of pure vanity, and General Alexander wanted to trap the German 10th Army up in northern Italy. Clark had to have his satisfaction and take Rome. Rome was not defended. The Germans promised they wouldn't defend the Holy City, and they didn't. And he had his glory, but it lost, lest the whole 10th Army get up there to Normandy. And it was a very foolish thing to do, because the two generals disagree, and the vanity of it. Monty versus Ike and so forth, they were always, well, Monty versus Patton as much as anything. And this is an interesting thing. I have a quotation here from Liddell Hart, who is by far the best Mormon military commentator of our times. I mean, he's written more and he's quoted more than anybody else, all through World War II as well as one. He goes way back there. See, there's a quotation from Liddell Hart. It's a very interesting one here, where he says, yes, he says, B.H. Liddell Hart, must know the name, I used to think the causes of war were predominantly economic. Well, there's a lot behind that, too. They are economic as far as that goes. Everybody profits by them. They're just raids, except, of course, the poor civilian that fights them. Then he says, I came to think that they were psychological. I am now coming to think that they are decisively personal, arising from the defects and ambition of those who have the power or influence to influence the current of nation. And this is certainly the Book of Mormon position. Behind every war, there is some powerful personality. In this case, it's Amalickiah, you see, and another one, Moroni. And it's the personal duel. It becomes so personal between Amalickiah and Moroni that it becomes a matter of drinking blood and this sort of thing, you see. But that's what it is. He says, after all these years, and he's been writing for 50 years on military affairs, and Liddell Hart, he's an Englishman, says he's finally come to the conclusion that it's just derived from the personalities. It's a personal thing, personal ambition and so forth. That's an interesting reflection. I just came across that the other day. And so we have this. The strength of character leads to a degenerate form of obstinacy. And we have a beautiful case of it here. We're on the 49th and 50th chapters of Alma now. When we read them presently, you'll see that all these cases are well illustrated when they refuse to give up at the fort until all the officers of the army are all killed off. They refuse, utterly stubborn, this sort of thing. After, in Lorraine, after Bastogne, they fell south and to strengthen, to straighten out the line and remove a bulge, General Taylor was ordered to fall back a mile. He said, gentlemen, this is a general meeting here, gentlemen, the 101st only advances, it never goes back. And so he immediately turned on his heel, stomped out of the room, went back and ordered an advance of another 10 miles, and another mile, yes, of another mile, and completely threw things off. But this is the stubborn, the will, the character, all this sort of thing that gets people promotions. That strength, but it leads to a degenerate form of sheer obstinacy, he says. Arguments among the staff are terrible. Moroni versus Patton. Versus Perron, Perron, Patton versus Monty, and so forth, and Eisenhower. General Bradley said, I never knew a general who was happy, because when you get up there, it's all fierce competition, and everybody's shooting for the top spot, and everybody's out to gunning for everybody else. The feelings run very high up there, the things they say about each other and so forth, and then they write books after, because it's so highly competitive scene. They never agree on any plan or project or anything else. And so, on that subject, Clausewitz concludes, we shall soon feel what a dangerous edifice war is, how easily it may fall to pieces and bury us in its ruin. Even up to the moment when you think you are winning, after Moroni settles everything, then bingo, comes a terrific counterattack like the bullets that catches us completely off guard. A dangerous thing. Well, we mentioned Agincourt last time. So, Clausewitz explains, decisions are based on reports, and this is of extreme importance, of course. Decisions are based on reports, all of which have been lies, exaggerations, and errors. Most reports are false, and the timidity of men gives fresh force to lies and untruths. The fog of war includes misreports, what happened, and so forth. What happens is what you want to have happen. Of course, I give many, many examples of that, but because you want to believe in the untruth. He's frank and honest in this. He says, this difficulty of seeing things correctly is one of the greatest sources of friction in war among the commanders. Thus, Moroni has no idea what's happening to Pahoran, and Pahoran the same way, you see. What does a general do in a case like this? As in Almory at 61. War, he says, in its plan, is so often thwarted by the unexpected. Of course, that's the nature. Napoleon says the first duty of a general is never to be surprised, but you're always being surprised. You can't help it. You don't know what's going to happen. Well, the best thing I can remember about General Taylor is the look of blank amazement on his face in a little schoolhouse where we were near Zone. And there was an assembly room in the back. It was a nice sunny day, and I went in and started to play Beethoven sonata on the piano, and suddenly a little wham bang, some shells come through the window and go out through the door, you see, with a great deal of noise. There were four Mark IV tanks on the other side of the canal. The canal was just the other side of the school, and there they were, the little grove there, and there they all were. So I went out the door, and just as I came out the door, there said General Taylor, his long arms hanging down, a look of utter amazement on his face. And suddenly a shell hit just above him and showered us completely with red brick dust. I was covered from head to foot with red brick dust. But nothing else but that, but he got a purple star out of it, a purple heart out of it, not a purple star. Then I had to go up there was a little church tower there, and went up the church tower to look, to see what was going on in the woods. And I went to the tower, but there were some nuns who said, oh, you can't come in here, and you can't come in here, there's a convent. We had to go up the tower. It was all carpeted in plush red carpet. It was a beautiful, sumptuously furnished place. But these nuns were all beflustered. They wouldn't let us go up the tower to look to see what was going on. And, I mean, that's the sort of thing that happens. Just a high comedy all the time. We don't like to talk. I say I've never talked about these things before. A, because they're a bore. War stories are a bore. And B, because people don't believe them. I don't blame them if they don't, I suppose. So I never tell stories that nobody's going to believe. But that was a relatively harmless event. Oh, it developed into things after that, of course, you can imagine. So it's so often thwarted by the unexpected that it must be conducted, it must be left to talent, must be left to a person who has the talent for it. Frederick the Great, Napoleon had genius, of course, Eugene, Marshal Saxe, oh, so many of them like that, the great generals were all eccentric geniuses. In fact, they were eccentric geniuses and only won wars by breaking rules. And so they established I won't say coveted, but the most prestigious medal in Europe is that which was given by the Austrians in the middle of the 17th century. And it remained right down through World War I, was the Maria Theresian. The Maria Theresian was the Medal of Maria Theresa. You got it for some brilliant achievement and success while you were breaking rules, against the rules. So there was a catch to it. When you got the Maria Theresian, you had to be shot after, because you disobeyed the rules. This is military thinking, you see. Now, this is true. See? So don't covet the Maria Theresian, because when you get the Maria Theresian, you've got to be taken out and be shot after you got it. It's a great honor, of course, but you shouldn't have done it. It was against orders that you won the battle, you see. And that's the way we have to follow the rules. So, so often thwarted by the unexpected. Well, and then he says this, for that reason, there's no other business, not in any other business that, in which theoretical guide is more useless, he says, in which less use can be made of a theoretical guide than in any other business. You can't use the vade mecum. I must tell you another one. I'm sorry, but this must come out. Camp Ritchie, I should notice Camp Ritchie's in the news today, is now Fort Ritchie, been exalted to Fort Ritchie, but that's where we trained, very secret, up in the Blue Ridge Mountains, right at Camp David there. And there I was for many months, and there was one fellow who had come from Washington who was always slightly drunk. He was always slightly stupid. His name was Mr. Tucker. But he came to beef us on absolutely top security, had the most secret things of all. And he talked about a wonderful woman by the name of Miss Crawford. Miss Crawford knew all the answers. She knew more about the war than anybody in existence. If you only would know what Miss Crawford knew, and so the mysterious Miss Crawford, you heard a lot about her. Then months passed, and I went to London, went to the War Office, went to the Hyde Park Corners, which is the military intelligence headquarters with the British. And from Hyde Park Corners, we were reassigned, and where did I get assigned to? To Miss Crawford. I got assigned to the great Miss Crawford. So I turned up at Whitehall first thing in the morning, with my pass and all my identification and everything. 9 o'clock in the morning, went up to Miss Crawford's place there and waited. She didn't show up till 10 o'clock, and then she bawled me out. Well, now I know 9 o'clock's the hour, but we don't come at that time. That wasn't the proper time to come. The British way of doing it, you see. And then at 11 o'clock, everybody would go up to the roof, on the roof of the War Office, and stand in a long queue clear around the building to wait for their tea. So you wait and you had your tea at 11 o'clock. Then at 12 o'clock, you'd come down, and there was time to go to lunch. So this is the way they ran it. Well, do any of you watch Yes Minister? It comes off Sunday nights over Channel 7. It's very good. It's exactly the way they do that. It's just as crazy as Yes Minister. It's a British comedy, a running spoof on the high government in Britain. I'm happy how, not only how human they are, but how silly they are. Well, this is the sort of thing that went on. But what was Mrs. Crawford? Oh, well, Miss Crawford, just a minute. She bustles in. She has a huge mop of fizzy red hair. She's an old maid, and she's very, very fussy. Now, what did I do with that? It seems, well, what we were doing, our job was to compose the vade mecum. The vade mecum was the British handbook. Had to be used by everybody, a bright red book, but very top secret. Make it as conspicuous as possible, see? This brilliant red cover called In Vade Mecum. See, it's a pun on Vade Mecum. Come with me, In Vade Mecum, invade with me. It was supposed to give you all the essential data, and what we were working on was the place and positions, of course, and strength of the German units. And you could follow them best by following where their commanders were vacationing or where they were moving or what they went to a meeting. And you could follow the high brass of the Germans if you could follow the newspaper reports and the popular magazines with their pictures in them and everything. And that was her sole source of information. She'd just go through the newspapers and the magazines. She'd clip them out, and she kept it. All her information was kept in a shoebox. And it was all messed up, and she'd go through trying to find. She had no filing system or anything. And this is the way we composed the vade mecum. This is the way we kept our thumb on the pulse of the German army. You see, little Miss Crawford there with her red fuzzy hair going through a shoebox full of scraps. I mean, it's too funny for words. Well, so he says, in no other business, and less use can be made of, they've edited this so much, that yes, use can be made of a theoretical guide than in any other business. No, you can't have a handbook of war, but and yet those are manuals for everything in the army, as you know. But for this, you can't have a manual, though they try to use it. So Clausewitz says throw away the rule book. It depends on the genius of the commander. Here's a thing that just came out in the paper on Friday. Warriors keep fighting edge in peacetime, and talks about that because an army's person is to aggress. I mean, you're not big and tough and strong just to defend yourself. You have to have some purpose for that, and we have to keep flexing our muscles and exercising all the time. The army will go to pieces unless it has activity. So a big military, inevitably, as Brigham Young says, is just as surely as we have those weapons, we're going to use them. There's only one way to use them, and that's the real thing. You just itch for that sort of thing. Won't talk about that now. But you learn in what you learn in Tolstoy's War and Peace, that wars go on, and Clausewitz says, it's the genius, it's old Suvorov, it's Napoleon, and so forth. Clausewitz says the thing that surprised most about, surprisingly, surprising about, well, what do you think it is? It's surprisingly simple. And I say, this just keeps taking me back to the Book of Mormon all the time. He's got it all there, and he's got the spirit of it, too. And then it fools everybody. That's why a talented genius, he says, the most intelligent person is not going to be the greatest generally. You want a man with a trait like character that thinks very simply, very directly, like Suvorov, or Marshall Forvets, or U.S. Grant. You see, they're not complicated, nervous men like Max Taylor, or ambitious men, or men like Frederick the Great, as far as that goes. But they're the ones that get through the long wars, you see. They have an instinct for what the right thing is and so forth to do. And here's another of Clausewitz's main doctrines, a central doctrine of strategy and tactics. And this is basic. He says, it's hard for people to believe this, but the defense is a stronger form of making war. Always. It's contrary to the prevalent opinion. The defensive form of war is the abstract, stronger than the offensive. Absolute defense completely contradicts the conception of war, he says. If you're just on the defensive, you're not waging war. You're just sitting there, you see. To wage war is to go forward and wage war. Marshall Forvets, as I say, he was the one that always go forward, and General Foch. He was losing everything, hand over foot. But he says, we've lost another 10 divisions. My plan is to attack. So he would attack every time. Because one policy didn't have any army left. All the time which elapses falls into the scale in favor of the defender. Well, any lawyer knows that. If you can draw out the case, the longer the better it is. Put off the confrontation as long as you can. But of course, every defensive, according to extremes, will have to change to the offensive sometime because that's war it is. It's extremely important always to bear in mind that the only advantage which the offensive possesses is one, the effect of surprise. If you're on the offensive, you must affect surprise because he's ready for you otherwise. Of course, that's the great trick that was fooled by the 2,000 sons. They surprised the daylights out of the Lamanites who were following. They never expected them to turn around like that. You have to be the innocent aggressor, yet you must make a surprise attack on someone else. You see, it's a very interesting thing, the contradiction here. Now, well, Max Taylor, I have to refer to him because he was the general of the division, and not only that, but he became later chief of staff, as I mentioned before, the whole army, navy, and everything else. But his grand passion was the reverse slope, as if it was a new discovery, the reverse slope. I had to preach reverse slope morning, noon, and night, but the general wasn't satisfied. The reverse slope was, you wouldn't dig in on the top of a hill and look over, like Bunker Hill, and look over the approaching enemy, giving you an advantage. He's coming up at you. Not at all. What you do is get at the bottom of the hill and wait for him to come across the ridge. Especially that was so with armor, because they make a fine profile against the sky. And that paid off magnificently. That's what paid the day at Bastogne. Because in one morning, they were able to knock off 44 tanks as they came across the hill. There was no way they could escape. They had to come down into Bastogne there. There was this bare hill. As soon as they'd pop up, we had these. They were also 44 tanks, but they were the 44 anti-tank guns. They were the new. They used to have the 37, 327th artillery. We had the new imported 44 anti-tank guns with long barrels. They were effective against anything. So they just knocked out all their tanks because they insisted on the same thing as with troops. You can't hide your profile on a reverse on the top of the hill. And it sounds contradictory, but it's remarkable how well it worked. Well, of course, in Holland, it didn't work too well. Everything was dead flat. So then we go on. Well, we claim defensive strategy. Clausewitz, another one of Clausewitz. A negative effort must prefer a bloodless decision. The less shed. Well, that was Moroni's. The only advantage of the negative object, though, is to delay a decision. That's Cold War. Because it must, he says, there's no point to Cold War unless it leads to hot war, which it will always do. It's a game to switch to war after all. You can stall all you want, he says, but everything, we're quoting him again, is subject to the supreme law, the decision by arms. When it is actually demanded by the enemy, such an appeal can never be refused. Accordingly, among all the objectives which may be sought in war, the destruction of the enemy's forces always must be the one that overrules all the others. So no matter how you spar, no matter how you wait, no matter how long you delay, no matter how strong your defensive position, this will be your objective sooner or later. You must destroy the enemy. Well, destroy means Moroni would just agree to go back home again. Because this is the idea of the warrior. See, remember, the person in the war, that's the game of chess. Once the king is taken, nobody's particularly loyal to him. Nobody was particularly loyal to Amalekiah at all, he says. They were suspicious of him yet. He got himself in that position. But as soon as he disappeared, the people had no objection to giving in. And Moroni says, well, go back home. Promise you'll be good after this. And they all went back. Well, that happened after the last war. We didn't worry after the armistice was signed. The Germans didn't bother us, the Japs and so forth. This leads to a policy adopted by the Generalstab in World War II, which, of course, is the Blitzkrieg. You must get it over with and get it over completely. And it came from Clausewitz. Quoting again, no conquest can be finished too soon. Don't drag it out. But wars always do drag out, you see. 6 weeks wars always turn out to be 5-year wars. You say, this will be over in 6 weeks. They always say that at the beginning. Remember at the Battle of Bull Run, well, this will finish that off. Well, it just started 4 years of wars, what it did, you see. They always say the same thing. They said, this war will be over by Christmas. When it began in August, well, it'd be over by fall. August 1914, same way here, this thing will be over in a few weeks. And it always turns out to be years. But he says, no conquest can be finished too soon. Spreading it over a greater period of time makes it more difficult. Of course it does. A speedy and uninterrupted effort toward a decision is essential to an offensive war. You just go and just keep going until you finished it off. Until it takes place, nothing is decided, nothing won. You may be winning up until the last minute, and then something will happen, and you'll be defeated. And this happens in the Book of Mormon, too. And nothing lost. The end crowns the work. War is an indivisible whole, you see. So how often defeat has been snatched from the jaws of victory, when you looked as if everyone's saying. And he says it must be an uninterrupted effort, and there is the catch, you see. If it drags on beyond a certain period, it can't be interrupted. You have to stop and take your breath. You have to stop and regroup. You have to stop and resupply. You have to do something. So unless you win that first blow, then you're in for a long haul. And nobody's ever yet won the first blow. That's what they tried at Pearl Harbor, you see. But always the slip-ups, always the delays and so forth. They didn't finish off. They didn't know that two carriers were still out to sea and so forth. And that was a great blow. So you can never that was the nearest thing to the Blitzkrieg that the Germans and Japanese were practicing at that time. So at Kamora, both sides lost, and it was a long war. This would be inconceivable to Clausewitz. He says, once the great victory is gained, there should be no talk of rest, pausing for breath, or consolidating, but only pursuit. Well, the Nephites were chased for 55 years. The Lamanites never let up that relentless pursuit, but it was an off and on sort of thing. But it was... That's the fatal flaw, I say. Every campaign has to slow down somewhere, as everybody did in World War II and so forth. And we could have pressed to the attack at an early finish, but we ran out of supplies. See, Patton was going great guns. Nothing was stopping him. But then there was no gas. Everything ground to a halt. And that was that. You can't get very far with tanks that way. And Patton couldn't get gas because Monty wanted it. See, there's your clash of personalities. Monty wanted it for his northern campaign. He wanted to go through Belgium. And so he got it, and he stalled down there. And so he says, beware of the confusing the spirit of army with its morale. The highest spirit in the world changes only too easy at first check to depression. And nobody knew that better than Moroni. He saw, no matter how great the elan and fury of the attacking enemy, there was a time when there was hesitation, then immediately he would propose conditions. And usually they would take him up on it. Zarahemla didn't, you know, he said, we'll go on fighting. There's always a check that comes in the Book of Mormon when the tide turns suddenly, and you have to sense when that time has come, and some men can do it. So his last principle is important. War is never an isolated act. In the real world, war never breaks out suddenly and does not spread immediately. He observes that in the modern wars are different. Now here we're going to have to disagree with him, see? He saw the principle in the Prince's Wars and the Gentleman's Wars of the 17th and 18th century fought by professional armies. But the 19th century and 20th centuries with the nation in arms, beginning with Napoleon, is something different, and for a good reason, which he applies. Human organizations, he says, have, because of their inefficiency, always fallen short. This is the answer. See, it's the human factor that's always going to spoil everything. You're not going to get your ideal war or anything else because the human factor, human organizations always fall short. Well, that's an understatement. We're seeing that a lot recently. Well, what about this fall in the market on Friday, you see? Which of the geniuses foresaw that? Nobody. You weren't warned about 200 200-point drop in the market, nothing. Human organizations always far so. There is bungling, misunderstanding, and deficiency. You never get things mobilized instantly. And these deficiencies, he says, operate on both sides and become a modifying influence. Of course, Hitler won D-Day for us because he refused to mobilize, refused to send his armor to Normandy, wanted to send it to Le Havre. That's why we have Cold Wars in the Book of Mormon, proceedings of men aspiring for position and jockeying for position. The Nephite-Lamanite wars were sometimes raids, a very common thing. All wars are raids anyway. They're corporate plunder. That economic feature is a very important one, though, because it is for plunder. It is for loot. Lots of looting. It's painfully within the first week in Normandy, we found a regimental, and I had to check out it because a regimental payroll, millions of marks. And we had to dump it in a general order that it be dumped in a foxhole and set fire, put kerosene on it and burn it up. Sandals, they were perfectly good money too. See, those millions of marks burning was rather painful. You can't resist it. The generals don't do it that way, you see. There was a place in Paris called Pilleville throughout the war. And this was the operation. Any officer there could change money, any money he wanted. Any officer at Pilleville. And it was a guichet. It was a window, a bank window, in Paris near sort of a granite building near the Seine there. And you see a long line of officers going clear around the block all down the river to change money there. See, what you would do, American dollars, say you could get, five times what it was worth on not just black market. Anybody was willing to give you five times the exchange value, you see. So you would get five times the exchange value. Then you would take it to Pilleville, and you could exchange it at the going rate, you see. And that way they would give you five times as much money as you got the first time. They'd give you $5. You see, you got 500 francs for $1, then you'd exchange that, and they'd give you $5, which is what it was worth. See? Then you'd take the $5 and do the same thing again. People would gladly pay you five times what that money was worth if they could get hold of the American dollars. So you do that again, you'd come back with five times five francs. And that way you could build up, and they did. Everybody was doing it. And every week, for months and months, all through 1944, the latter half of 1945, the army would officially announce, the last deal at Pilleville will be on Tuesday. Next Tuesday it closes for good. There have been complaints. Next week will be final. This is the final date. They're always saying the last day for Pilleville, but they never closed. You could always go change your money. And the chief officer of Le Vésinet, which was the military headquarters out at Le Vésinet in Paris, west of Paris there, and MIT Center, he would fly over to England regularly for all the boys and come back with all sorts of money exchanged, you see, that he could get pounds and dollars and come back and change them for lira and guilders and francs and so forth, and then back to make the change back and forth, and they build up lots of money. So that was looting. If any of us kept any money we found, that was a court-martial offense. You couldn't do that. But there's ways of doing things. But it is a raid. When Zoram went out, he said it was to obtain those who had been carried away and captive into the wilderness. War is a raid anyway, you see. And remember Zoram of the Zoramites? His original purpose in going out was a raid to bring back captives in the wilderness, just as Abraham went against the four kings. And Lawrence's whole war was a Gaza. The Arabs call it the Gaza. Our word raid is from the Arabic Gaza. As long as we leave, we shall Gaza, is what they say. We have a raid. And it was a matter of raids, but it was an effective war. You strike and loot and take what you can, but for getting something back. His whole purpose was to get them back. And we read in Alma 16 and so forth. Well, Clausewitz has something to say that amuses us here, I think. This is good. This sounds almost comical today. He says, if wars of civilized nations are far less cruel and destructive than those of uncivilized, the cause lies in the social conditions of these states internally and the relation to each other. We just didn't destroy cities wantonly or things like that the way the barbarians used to do. No, we would never burn a city or a palace out of the question. Or just kill citizens. We'd be very careful never to shoot a civilian or anything like that. Well, civilian laws are far greater in war than anybody else now. And the various documentaries on TV show us in the primitives and animals that they do fight. Savages and animals do fight. They fight all the time, but they know when to stop. It's a sort of exercise. They never really badly hurt each other because that would spoil the game, and they know when to stop. But we don't. That's the difference, see. Neither did the warlords of the steppes. They're what Clausewitz had in mind when he talked about the barbarians and their ways of war. We're civilized. We wage civilized warfare today. Well, they say that's humorous. Good joke. We should all be roaring, lying, rolling on the floor, eh? He was thinking of certain wars in Russia. He says they are unthinkable in our society because you can't exterminate a whole nation. A thing like that is out of the question. You try to do that. People would try to do that, but that's exactly what the great Khans did, what Genghis Khan and Kublai Khan did, exterminate whole tribes and whole nations. And that's the expression used in the Book of Mormon. When the time comes that the voice of the people should choose iniquity and fall into transgression, they would be ripe for destruction. When the cup is full, they shall be swept off from the face of the land. Ye shall become extinct, is the prophecy that is given after one of their happiest wars. Then Clausewitz says, since Bonaparte, the people in arms, was unknown before him, has approached much nearer to its real nature, to its absolute perfection, the Napoleonic Wars were real wars. He burned everything on the way. He didn't spare anything. Then he says, the most violent element, he's in ecstasy about this, the most violent element of war, freed from all conventional restrictions, broke loose with all its natural force. This is the way it should be, you see. And Mormon says, from this time forth, the Nephites began to be swept off, even as the dew before the sun. Very powerful expression. Nothing left. Sweeps everything before the dew before the sun. Combing the land. It just wasn't a spot engagement here and there that would lead to a conference between the rulers or something like that. No, it was a total thing. The most violent element of war, like a violent natural force, like a plague sweeping a nation, appears when, we're quoting good old Clausewitz now, when freed from all conventional restrictions, it broke loose with all its natural force. It is a natural phenomenon. There are no more artificial or other restraints. War is much nearer to real nature in absolute, she says. Well, Operation Barbarossa in 1941, as you know, June 41, was when Hitler was entered Russia. They were to destroy absolutely everything. And within 2 weeks, they had taken a third of Russia. The vastest country in the world had already gobbled up a third of it, completely, with total destruction, as fast as they could go. So, Clausewitz was wrong, too, because he didn't have the nuclear bomb. And what's more, a final word from Clausewitz, he couldn't conceive of the scale of war, of wars today, or the arms production, or of the nature of some weapons. And well, he says this, in the great combats we call wars, there is usually no hostile feeling of individual against individual. That's very true. I told you the last time General Taylor wanted to invite the colonel who was defending Carentan to tea. He says, I admire him, I admire what he'd done, I want you to go invite him to tea. Well, we called that off when the Germans resented that sort of thing. The colonel didn't get the point. The first person who was interrogated, in fact, was the colonel who was very badly wounded. He refused to say anything. He was very proud and just died, and that was all. He's going on here. Excuse me. We're talking about emotions wrought up here. National hatred becomes more or less powerful substitute for personal hostility of individuals. Where this is absent, a hostile feeling is kindled by the combat itself, by an act of violence, will excite us to the desire to retaliate and be avenged when the violence stops. But you have to whip it up first. And you know that wonderful passage where he tells us how Amalickiah had towers, the towers, special speakers to go to all the towers throughout the country and whip up emotional resentment against the Nephites, get the people worked up until they were willing to go to war. They were very reluctant after the long one, but this time he used that technique, just like that using TV. He kept hammering away at it with these speakers from the towers, and the first three verses of the 48th chapter, the one we just had, and he did that, the very same thing. Here's an interesting statement from General MacArthur. Now, there's a great personality and a great poseur and so forth, and yet a powerful personality. We have to thank him more than any other person for the settlement, the sensible, amicable settlement of the Japanese question after the war. And he says here, Yes, here's General Douglas MacArthur writing in 1957 when that tension was on. He says, our government has kept us in a perpetual state of fear, kept us in a continuous stampede of patriotic fervor with a cry of grave national emergency. Always there has been some terrible evil to gobble us up if we did not blindly rally behind it by furnishing the exorbitant sums demanded. Yet in retrospect, these disasters seem never to have happened, seem never to have been quite real. Of course, that's exactly, well, you can make them happen, that's the point. It's a self-fulfilling sort of thing, as in the case of Amalickiah, when he set up the towers and got the people all whipped up into a passion here. So the Book of Mormon is right on track here, isn't it? And then once it starts, of course, then the desire for revenge. This is the big thing. And the Book of Mormon ends in an orgy of revenge. As you know, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, fourth chapter of Mormon there. When against all that the Lord had taught them, they went out for revenge. He said, vengeance is mine. Behold, the justice of God will overtake the wicked, and it is by the wicked that the wicked are punished. You will not revenge. Vengeance is mine. But that was the theme. That was the time, remember, Mormon says, when I saw that against all the Lord has taught them, they were determined to revenge themselves upon their brethren. He says, from that time I did utterly refuse to go against mine enemy. I became an idle onlooker to record these things for your benefit. So it must be for our benefit. And so he gets it going. Well, you see the theme, of course, the good guy sees his friends cut up, and so he seeks vengeance. It's the theme, the dominant theme by far on TV every night now, as you may notice. You have to have a motive for going. You can't just go out and shoot somebody. They have to be very bad, and you have to have some reason for shooting so that the person is all excited and wants to see these people get their comeuppance. So they must do something very wicked at first. So you always start out, the pattern is, you start out by some grave crime being committed against the innocent or something, crimes of violence, this, that, and the other. The private eye's best friend gets shot. It's a routine. They work it over and over and over. Then the rest of the play is seeking for vengeance. Then that's what keeps us interesting. We see, will he get the vengeance? Will it catch up with him, you see? That's what makes all the great tragedies interesting. So, Oedipus to Macbeth, is this going to catch up with him? Revenge is the whole thing, Mormon says at the end. Mormon 3 and 9. And now, because of this great thing which my people, the Nephites, had done when they won a great victory against all expectations, they began to boast of their own strength and began to swear before heaven that they would avenge themselves of the blood of their brethren who had been slain by their enemies. But what nobler motive can that be than to avenge the blood of their brethren? With that, Mormon lays down his arms. He resigns as commander, says he will have nothing more to do with them. He utterly refuses to be avenged on his enemy. For one thing, the Lord has absolutely forbidden them to do seeking vengeance. And so Mormon says, 3:14 and 15, Mormon, for I heard the voice of the Lord saying, vengeance is mine and I will repay. Well, where does that leave us today, short of Zion, you see? But this 50th chapter is a... It's a good, well, the 49th chapter. Notice, we tried his strategy at work. They were exceedingly, here is a marvelous passage here. I think the best thing is to follow along here so we can not lose our place here. Yes, turn to the 49th chapter now. And there's a very good thing. Well, in the 10th verse, he has a good point there. But first in this 6th verse, notice these things slip up. There's no better known maxim that the generals always plan the next war in terms of the last war. They always fight the last war because that's where their experience is. That's where they can correct their mistakes. They talk it over. They endlessly argue what they would have done and what this person should have done and that person should have done. The English are great on that. But they prepare that. And exactly what had happened here. Notice this neat touch here in the 6th verse. Because they supposed that they should be privileged to come upon them as they had hitherto done. Yea, and they had also prepared themselves with shields and with breastplates. They were getting ready for the other war, the war that they had hitherto been victorious in. They had hither with shields and with breastplate. Well, this is Nephi's people. And they had also Moronis. And they, with garments of skin, very thick garments to cover their nakedness. Well, but to their utter astonishment, notice they had matched the Nephites' armor, but they, all the things that they had hitherto done, they were doing now, but that wasn't enough because Moroni was ahead of them. See, Moroni was a real military genius. Now, the... notice the 10th verse, it tells us that, of course, Amalickiah stayed back at the base And confident in a quick and easy victory, he didn't care for the blood of his people. We're told in 49 and 10, and that happens too. And then, in the 11th verse here, another. Notice the inside of this 11th verse. You don't just go to war by improving the army that way and by improving the defenses. That wasn't it at all. He said he shook up the whole administration of the government. Notice he was given plenary powers here to do this thing in this crisis. So he shook up the government from top to bottom. Got things moving. You notice, for Moroni had altered the management of affairs among the Nephites. It wasn't just a military preparation. He altered the management of the affairs. I mean, it was a government shakeup, probably from top to bottom. That was very important if you're going to be efficient. Once you've lost the war, you can't have the same duds back home. The Lamanites were disappointed in their places of retreat. They couldn't come upon them anyway. Well, and they retreated back into the wilderness. They always had this nice wilderness to fall back on, you see. And then his chief captains, they thought that they could make the city of Noah an object lesson. Notice in the 13th verse here. Forces of security for every city. They marched toward the land of Noah with a firm determination. Yea, their chief captains came forward and took an oath that they would destroy the people of that city. They were so mad because they'd been turned back. It's exactly what the Germans did in 1914. They were going to make an object of Antwerp. And that slowed them down long enough for the French to make some resistance, set up the Battle of the Marne. But the Germans are great on doing that, on swearing oaths, and they'll destroy something. Well, Lidice, the village in Czechoslovakia, you know, where every man, woman, and child was killed, just in revenge because one SS personnel was killed there. And so this is what they're doing here. And they took an oath they'd destroy the city. And that's 13 to 17 here. Well, the man says here, the supreme test of generalship is to have the enemy play the game your way. And Moroni was very good that way. He made Amalickiah do just the things he wanted Amalickiah to do, while Amalickiah thought it was his own idea. You see, now that's generalship when you can do that. And this is possible, you see. Have the enemy play your game, making just the moves you want him to make under the impression he's being very smart on his own. Moroni did just that. The attack on the city of Noah was according to his desires. They were drawn off. See, the city of Noah looked weak, and this is the one they would attack. They would take their vengeance. They would make an example of it. And that's exactly what Moroni was counting on. See, he knew his psychology. Very shrewd man here. And now behold, this was wisdom in Moroni, for he had supposed that they would be frightened at the city of Monaha, and as the city of Noah had appeared the weakest part, therefore, that's where he thought they'd go. And Lehi's two generals were Teancum and Leahan, they were terrors. And then they came to Noah and they were again disappointed. That was terrible. He had devised a new ingenious type of defense for the city. We see how the death trap, a new type of gate for the Lamanites. And they took their oath to wipe out the inhabitants of the city of Noah. And as they make these savage, repeated assaults on the city, it was silly. Description of a siege and fortification, the body of their strongest men with their swords and their slings to smite down by the place of the entrance. They got trapped there because it was an L entrance, that kind. You couldn't go in directly. The place of entrance, that's where Moroni had devised a clever kind of gate. And this is the arch perversity, you see, of attacking strong places that can't be held. Well, Arnhem is the classic example there. I think in our war, driven back from time to time, insomuch that they were slain with immense slaughter. They began to dig down their banks. Oh boy. Began to dig down their banks, and they were swept off by the arrows. The chief captains were slain. All the chief captains were slain. More than 1,000 were slain. What stubbornness. There was not a single soul left of the Nephites slain. They had the advantage of that battle. But this happened, you know, just before this. Going over to Holland, it was discovered that the Germans had a number of panzer divisions. They had armored divisions resting at Arnhem. They were resting and recouping and rearming at Arnhem, the worst place to go for light airborne to assault. They were to take that bridge. General Browning, who was the British commander there, asked Monty, who was living in his trader house way back in Brussels there somewhere, and he said, how long will we have to hold that bridge? He was to go in suddenly, as you know, and hold the bridge. He says, and Montgomery snapped at him. He's almost mad at him. He said, 24 hours at the most, 2 days at the most. We'll be up there before that, but if you can hold on. Well, he says we can hold on for 2 days, for 4 days, but I think you've chosen a bridge too far, and that's what I gave the name to the movie, you see. They've chosen a bridge too far, and that made Monty very mad. But General Sir Miles Dempsey came down and gave us a little pep talk on vision here. And he came to headquarters, and we all stood around him, and he says, as soon as you land on the road, get off the roads as fast as you can. Get off the road. I'll be coming down those roads with my tanks 2 abreast, 40 miles an hour. These little narrow Dutch roads with big ditches on either side to drain them. One tank might get by. All you had to do was have 188, and you could block the whole thing, which is exactly what what happened. 2 weeks later, we hadn't seen a British tank. And they hadn't come in at all. That was Sir Miles Dempsey. He was the husband of Daphne du Maurier, who wrote that famous novel, Rebecca. So these were illustrious people, you see. They had to be the aristocracy. But that confidence, get off the road as quick as you can, we'll be coming down 2 abreast, 40 miles an hour. 2 weeks later, well, it was more than 2 weeks later, a British tank lumbers in, and we kidded the guys. It was a communications tank, had no weapons or anything else. But the fellows with it had Browning guns. They were all filled with mud and sand. Said, well, you don't know things. They just effect. We just use them for effect and so forth. It was much later that any more tanks came in. But this is, well, then, you see, I mean, before it came, here we are up at Arnhem. You had only 5 miles to go then. And the last minute, we discovered that there were two, well, it goes back to the most famous British spy, who was called Ultra. That was Sir Stuart Menzies, who became the boss in the novels, of 007, you know, James Bond. James Bond's boss was Menzies. That was Ultra. Well, he was the one, he was a real man. He was getting information at this time, and he sent back reliable information. But Monty gave orders that the information should only come to him, that Eisenhower should not find out about it, because he might call the thing off if it looked too bad, and it did look much too bad. So we're not supposed to get it. So the night we were to leave, we hopped into the Jeep with, we were to land there from there, so we hopped into the Jeep with Captain, not Kipnis, yes, Kipnis, of course. He was the nephew of Alexander Kipnis, the famous Basso. See, everybody's related to everybody in genealogy. And so we dashed down to Southampton to Chafe, to the big headquarters, to find out all the information. We've heard that there's some, well, actually, there was the 9th Panzer, the armored division, there were the 10th Panzer, and there were the 2nd SS Panzer, 3 big armored divisions right where this battalion, well, it wasn't even a battalion, of paratroopers to land, and they were supposed to take a bridge against that opposition. We didn't know they were there. We didn't know what was there, and we wanted to find out. So as we dashed down, it's a funny time, it was late in the day, and we come in, and a typical Oxford Don sitting at the desk there in the, at Chafe headquarters, and he said, we have to know where we're landing, we're going tonight. He says, well, I can give you the information, but you'll have to ask it through proper quarters, through proper channels. He says, I'm not going to give you that now. Well, yes, I said, but we're going to, I didn't say that, the captain said it. Hey, yes, but we're going tonight, we have to land there tonight, we want to know what's there. No. These things have to be done in proper order, really. We have to do this. We haven't been given any order to let this material go. You'll just have to wait for it. We can let you have it in a week. 2 weeks, maybe, but perhaps in a week. If you go fast, we can put it in. If you put in your request now, we can let you have it in a week. Well, well, well. While Kipnis was arguing with him, I slipped around and went through the door into the map room in there, where an old friend of mine from Camp Ritchie was there. I knew him back there. And so he let me take what I wanted. And I got these maps and photographs and stuffed them under my coat like this and buttoned the coat. That was the information we wanted. And went out. That's the only way you could get it, you see. This is the way things are done. I mean, it is right out of that thing, you know, yes, minister, the same sort of thing done. But there they were with all this, and they had an SS division, they had everything under the sun resting up there, and they didn't want to let anybody know, because if we knew, they'd call it off, and that was Monty's, he always wanted this dagger thrust at the heart of Germany. We would just go through there, and, well, as General Sir Miles said, in 2 days, well, 2 days, he said, 2 days at the most, and we'll have it all won, the army will be taken, the war will be over, and so 2 days it went on until December, yes, until about the 10th of December. It began the 16th of September and was still going on, and then we were beat. We just had to pull out. Nothing came of it. Complete collapse as far as that goes. So, you know what it's like to be on the losing side. But as it says here. Now, I mean, this is very good stuff here. And then you have this here. They were swept off with stones and arrows, and then the Lamanites, they fled. The Amalekites went to inform their king, and Amalekai, back at headquarters, he had a tantrum. Heads would roll. Boy, in those high-level tantrums or something, the general enjoys the luxury of getting very, very mad. I mean, they absolutely become purple with rage. He was exceedingly wroth. He did curse God and also Moroni, swearing with an oath that he would drink his blood. Notice the psychology of that is of Medellin, of the Ayatollah, the Hezbollah. This is the type of psychology we never had until today, you see. The idea of going all the way. The only solution we have is to murder, to drink his blood and so forth. This man is insanely, obsessed with this sort of thing. Until we got tangled up with the Muslims, we didn't know what that meant, to get so bloody-minded as that. But we have it today in the world. But believe it or not, he won the war, and they had great peace and prosperity after because of their diligence. And then Helaman, Coriantum, and Amphion, they were ruling elsewhere. But we'll get... Well, I was saying we'd come down to earth the next time, but I'm afraid we won't. We'll just dig in deeper. This next chapter is marvelous because this takes us back home during the war. What things happen, how people behave during times of great stress, not in the military.